You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 108, our 14th Q&A. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike, how you doing?
Good. How are you, Trey?
I'm doing pretty good, Mike. Well, before we get started here, I wanted to challenge our listeners. You know, we need to come up with a clever name for our listeners, like Naked Nation or something. I don't know, but yeah, I know.
Let's not do that one.
All right. Well, I want to challenge our listeners, Mike. We have enough listeners, thousands of listeners, and whether you use iTunes or the Google Play app to listen to our podcast, if you could go rate us or subscribe to us on the Android Play, we'd appreciate it. We, out of the thousands of listeners, we've got about 33 ratings on iTunes. So even if you don't listen it through iTunes, if you could at least go leave a rating or a review, we'd appreciate it. And to be honest, Mike, if everybody left one of those, we would skyrocket to the very top. Because most of the popular podcasts have, you know, a couple thousand ratings.
Are you saying if our listeners did that, I would like be ranked above people like Joel Osteen?
Yes. Yes. This is okay, what I'm talking about.
Let's consider that a mission.
Exactly. I want to challenge our listeners. By the end of the year, Mike, I want to have like 1,000 or 2,000 ratings or something. There's no reason not to. We have enough people to do that. So even if you don't, if you have an iPhone, all you got to do is open up your Apple podcast app, go to the Naked Bible, and then rate us right there. You don't even have to leave a review if you don't want to. But
yeah, that would be a nice Christmas present for me to.
Yeah,
to
I want to try to expand. This is my.
Yeah. Gives me a little hope, you know.
Absolutely. That would be neat.
Something that isn't soul crushing, you know, just. That would be great.
Yeah, and also on the Google side, too. If you go subscribe to our podcast on that side as well, we'd appreciate it to help other people discover us.
Mm-hmm. We're discovering that a lot of these sorts of things really are based on input like this. I mean, when people like something or rate something, they may not think it actually does anything, but it really does. You know, I had Naked Warriors just popped into my head.
Naked Warriors, like, there you go.
That's like the Picts, you know, if you know anything about
it. And instead of Naked and Afraid, we could be Naked in the Bible. Yeah,
we don't need any like early medieval Pictish, you know.
Nude Nation. We need something to do with the nude, naked, buff.
See, then we really would be part of the occult conspiracy right there.
Well, that's okay, you know. At least it'd increase our listenership, right? Yeah, it'd be reaching to people who actually need it, so that's actually a positive. All right, Mike, well, let's jump into our questions here if you're ready.
Sure.
All right, let's do this. Our first two questions are from Mark from Frankfurt, Germany. His first question is, Genesis 2 and 3 seems to indicate that mankind had conditional mortality with them having access to the tree of life and then being kicked out of the garden. How does this affect the future judgment? What happens to a person who dies without Christ? What is your take on eternal punishment, annihilation, etc.? How does the resurrection of the unjust fit into this?
Well, I mean, you know, if Adam and Eve, again, I do believe they had conditional immortality. In other words, if they wouldn't have sinned and they perpetually abide in the presence of God, essentially God's house, so to speak, Eden, they would have kept on living. Okay, so I would say it's conditional immortality. You know, everybody has, if we want to reverse the language, everybody's mortal. You know, they're gonna die of something. So I'm given the way I'm adjusting the wording here, I'm not quite sure what is sort of troubling, you know, Mark to ask the question, but I'll take a stab at it. I mean, if they're kicked out of the garden and really the rest of humanity sort of follows this template that we aren't born into the presence of God, we are, you know, have to be brought back into relationship with God. That's just another way of saying salvation is needed. So that is you know, kind of the one thing that to me just seems the, you know, the most obvious, if we're going back to this, to the Edenic scene and then thinking about it theologically, what happens to a person who dies without Christ? Well, they have a Christless eternity. They spend eternity outside the presence of God, the family of God. They, to use other, you know, scriptural language, they're lost, that sort of thing. That naturally takes us into where the questioner, you know, took us, you know, what's your take on eternal conscious punishment or annihilation, so on and so forth. I think for me, both of those things are actually still on the table. And I've said before on the podcast that, you know, it really depends on how you read certain language, especially in the book of Revelation when it describes, you know, final judgment. So when I look at it, the thing that really puts annihilation on the table for me is the reference to the death of death, both in Revelation and also one place in 1 Corinthians. You know, if death itself is truly destroyed, and that is what you actually read, you know, in the book of Revelation, then I don't know how death could be eternally ongoing. It's either destroyed or it's not. And so annihilation seems to make a lot of sense in respect to that verse. And of course, if you have annihilation, that's permanent. So the judgment is permanent. The separation is permanent. The does it have to be conscious, you know, is really the question for some people. And some will take like Revelation 14:11, the smoke of their torment descends forever and ever. Well, if they were destroyed, again, the results of that are permanent too. And the smoke could just be a reference to the fact that they had been destroyed. They had been consumed and annihilated in the flames. So the language of going up forever and ever just doesn't really help resolve the debate. That's part of why there is a debate. So I think for me, both of those things are on the table. If push came to shove, I think annihilation makes the best sense, but it's certainly not the only view that you could come out of that passage, you know, and at least one other with. Again, it's hard for me to see how death itself could be destroyed and yet be ongoing in an eternal way. Those two things just don't seem to go together. But again, I'm not willing to, you know, to sort of push the more traditional view to the side. But I think annihilation really needs serious consideration. Like I said, for me, they're both on the table.
Okay. Mark also wants to know, what is the relationship between the heavenly host as divine beings and the celestial objects? Why does Paul mention the celestial bodies in the context of the bodily resurrection? Some occult and esoteric teachings hold to the belief that the heavenly bodies are living creatures. What is your take on this?
Yeah, well, for the part of the question, why does Paul mention the celestial bodies in the context of bodily resurrection? The answer is, please listen to the David Burnett episode. I mean, we spent well over an hour talking about that passage, so I'm not going to try to, you know, shortcut that and, you know, really not do it justice. For the other parts of the question, what's the relationship between these two things and, you know, the occult and esoteric teaching? I'll just take that one. You know, what's my take on that? I don't believe for a minute that heavenly bodies are living creatures. Okay, heavenly bodies are rocks and gas or whatever, you know, astronomy, you know, tells us. But you have to realize, you know, in the ancient world, they don't know any of this. And so there are celestial objects in the heavens that move around. And so some people, not everybody, I mean, the ancient world is just like our modern world. Do all people on any given subject all agree? Do they all think the same way or the same thing on any given subject? The answer is no. And people in the ancient world were the same way. So what I'm going to say here isn't monolithic. There were a variety of positions or ideas. But there were many people who looked up in the heavens and say, hey, those things are moving around up there, and they're not us, they're not human, so therefore they must be divine. In other words, they don't have a default astronomical science category, at least if you're appealing to the masses here. And so the conception was that either they are living beings that are moving around, and those who thought, well, maybe they're not living beings, maybe they are like things, you know, objects in the sky, but maybe they're empowered by the gods or by living beings. You know, you had that view too. So when a person in the ancient world decided to worship one of these things, regardless of what they're thinking, you know, is it a living being? Is it a piece of something, an object empowered by a living being? You still have idolatry. You are still worshiping this object with the thought that, well, what I'm viewing with the naked eye really isn't an object, it's a deity, or what I'm viewing with the naked eye is an object, but it's empowered and controlled by a deity that I am now going to worship. So this is why it's condemned, you know, in Scripture as worshiping, to borrow a New Testament phrase, worshiping the creature more than the creator. You know, that's the relationship. There is no one view of this in antiquity. And Paul, you know, understands this. I mean, he mentions this, that some people believe, you know, that these are divine beings, or whether they're Jew, Gentile, whatever. Again, there is no monolithic one position on any given topic. And what he wants is, no, worship the God of Israel, worship the Creator, not these other things, regardless of what you think they are, even if you're right or if you're wrong. You worship the Creator, not the creature, not the thing created. So that's, I think, sort of the quick version of the way I would answer that.
All right. CJ has a question. And how do we reconcile that the culture informed the Israelites' view of cultic worship and even morality, while at the same time acknowledging that God transmitted commandments, ordinances, and God-given morality at Sinai? Was God borrowing morality, cultic worship from other cultures while claiming that it was good and acceptable? Or was it a mere coincidence that God had decreed the Israelites to obey their already established cultural preferences?
Well, I think part of the answer to this is, you know, Paul talks about the law of God being written on a person's heart, whether they had the actual law or not, you know, referring to, you know, pagans as, you know, this is the basis for why they do righteous things and why they are accountable to God, and why they are, you know, their actions can be judged one way or the other as being right or wrong. You know, there's some people would use the phrase natural law. You know, they're just these sort of God-given orientations within a human being that you know are just there to give everyone a sense of right and wrong, whether that is codified in a document or not. So I think that's part of what's going on here. God's not like saying, "Hey, I'm out of moral things now. I need to go borrow one from a pagan or from some other culture." You know, God doesn't run out of ideas and have to go borrow some moral principle. That's not, you know, the way to look at the cultural similarity. I mean, cultural similarity, even if there no law or no written law exists, again, Paul would say, well, that's because we're created as images of God, and we have this thing called a conscience. You know, we have this sort of built-in sense of right and wrong. So even whether it's written down or not, or, you know, various forms of it that might be similar, might have some differences, it's still, you know, trying to work out this sense of right and wrong. So that's part of what's in view here. People were who, I think, just again, generally, you know, speaking, people were who they were when God decided to meet them and use them or enter into a covenant relationship with them. So when it comes time to, you know, actually talking about the laws of Israel, you know, God's law, you know, the stipulations of those laws were designed to keep Israel distinct sometimes, and most importantly, that distinction meant not worshiping another god. Okay. At other times, you know, the laws would more or less just teach certain ideas about the unique God of Israel. In other words, the way God viewed creation, the way God viewed, you know, what he had done, or taught the Israelites something about God's character. We talked when we were in Leviticus a lot about the idea of creation order. Again, that teaches us something about the nature of God, and God himself looks, you know, at what he has made. He brings order out of chaos, and so there's an order to creation that certain laws are designed to teach people that idea and maintain a creation order way of conducting your life or looking at relationships. So, you know, some laws are designed to teach us something about the character of God, or the way God looks at things, you know, not mixing certain things, whether it's fabrics, you know, again, talking, going back to Leviticus here, again, teaching the bigger idea of not mixing the holy with the profane, the sacred with the profane. And some laws just exist for that reason and that reason only, to teach us about a principle that is important to God, that is built into the fabric of creation as he made it. And he wants us to understand it, how he looks at it, and live accordingly and think accordingly about how we are part of creation and how that should affect our behavior. Sometimes, you know, things may have seemed more normative to an Israelite, you know, that a particular law and the law of Moses would be like, well, yeah, you know, of course, you know, we would do this or not do that, because again, their own sense of right and wrong innately, or their own, you know, cultural sense of you should do this or not do that. A specific law and the law of Moses would be, you know, right alongside that, you know, very consistent with it. You know, what to do with, I hate to say it, what to do with you know, human excrement. Okay, there are laws about that. Again, that's tied to sacred and profane thinking, you know, in respect to, you know, holy ground and non-holy ground and, you know, being defiled and so on and so forth. But yet the average person in the ancient world, you know, would just know that, okay, when we should be doing this outside the camp. We don't do it in the house. We don't do it where the kids play. I mean, there's just normative things in life that are reflected in Old Testament law, but then since they're in Old Testament law, they're often given a higher meaning or a theological orientation to them, to teach some bigger, you know, more abstract principle. And I think you have that with food laws, for instance. Again, some of that would have been normative, but again, given a theological meaning. Other laws were, you know, were not you know, normative. They would have been newer. They would have had an immediate specific context, you know, don't offer sacrifices to goat demons, you know, anymore. Well, again, that's a specific, you know, situation that Israelites were encountering in the wilderness. You know, we have the whole goat for Azazel thing that's related to that. Again, there's specific context to certain things. You know, Mosaic law isn't just one kind of law, and the laws in it are not, don't arise from one point of origin or one context. It's a very variegated thing, and so it's a little hard to talk, you know, terribly specifically about what this or that thing meant and how it relates to you know, to a culture or what, because there's going to be some variance with that depending on what it is, and again, even where it's placed in the law and you know, what category it falls into. I would say, you know, even after God removed many of these sort of distinctiveness barriers, you know, like in New Testament times, you know, with Peter and the apostles and the Gentiles being brought into the people of God and so on and so forth. Even when some of these barriers are removed, there was no compulsion or no insistence that the Jews go do something that would frankly make them uncomfortable. You know, well, now that we have the church, now every Jew is, you know, has to eat pork. Well, there's no law like that. You know, God's not going to care if they eat pork or not. You know, so that's what Paul says. Some honor this day over that day. Some eat this and don't eat that. You know, whatever. The whole point is that you don't judge someone's spiritual status by whatever decision they make on those things. So there's latitude, even when, again, the laws of distinction are sort of dispensed with. That doesn't mean you're compelled now to do something that is really ingrained in your culture, let's say as a Jewish convert. You're not forced to do that. So I think there's just a lot of things to think about here, and it's not a very neat, you know, subject that you can just sort of put in one drawer and then, okay, I understand it now. There's just a lot more going on, you know, when it comes to law and why we have some laws and what they mean and what people are supposed to think and were they normative or not? Are they new? Are they old? Are they familiar? Unfamiliar? Again, it's just a big playground, you know, that has, you know, lots of stopping points and lots of categories.
All right. Gabriel in Dallas, Texas has three questions. And his first one is, I've noticed that on numerous occasions, Mike says that scripture tells us that the Nephilim were done away with in the Old Testament. Why then are there still instructions that are suggestive of the angels still having potential to be enticed? For instance, If the reference to angels and the head covering harken back to Genesis 6, why is that significant unless cohabitation is still possible? Also, why does it matter if a woman's hair is covered in the new covenant?
Well, I would say first, you know, the wording of the question sort of presumes that the watchers and the sons of God and the Nephilim are kind of the same, but they're not. You know, and I think, you know, that the questioner understands that, but the wording, the way the question's worded makes me just wonder a little bit. So I just start there. 1 Corinthians 11 obviously doesn't mention Nephilim, but the gist of the question is, why was Paul concerned? Well, the fact that Paul would be concerned about angelic enticement is no justification for arguing that there are Nephilim now. It just means he was concerned. In other words, it means exactly what you would think it would mean, that in Paul's mind, that this possibility was there. Okay, a possibility is not an actuality. Again, these are just simple ways of just thinking coherently about the topic we're discussing. You know, the instructions Paul give, you know, really, I don't even like the word instructions. You know, they're not instructions that Paul writes in 1 Corinthians 11 about the head covering, in the sense that Paul's saying, do X, because if you don't do X, then Y will happen. Okay, that isn't the sense of what Paul's doing. Rather, Paul's advice shows he's concerned. He considers a Genesis 6-like event to, you know, perhaps be possible. That doesn't mean it was happening. It doesn't mean it would happen again. Okay, Paul's just reflecting a fear or concern, something, again, that's kind of lurking in the back of his mind. But there's no guarantee that if someone who, you know, some woman who listened to Paul and read that and said, well, forget that, I'm leaving my head covered, I'm doing what I want, you know, flaunt my sexuality, that doesn't mean that something's going to happen to her. In other words, the cause and effect mechanism here is not being taught in 1 Corinthians 11. 1 Corinthians 11 is not teaching a cause-effect reality, and in some cases, even a potentiality. What it does, what Paul's wording suggests, is that in his mind, he thought that there was, you know, there's a reason to be concerned. There's some possibility here, but we can't sort of convert that possibility in Paul's head to something that would indeed happen. Possibilities are just that. They are possibilities. They are not actualities. A potentiality is not an actuality. Again, we could just go over these terms like this to try to draw the distinction, but I think, you know, that would get a little annoying. So I would just say Paul isn't predicting anything. His words reflect a concern of his. There's no evidence from the fact that he was concerned that anything was happening. The Old Testament does make it quite clear that the giant clan lines were destroyed. You know, that's the whole point of what happens with the Rephaim, the remnant there, you know, flees to the cities of the Philistines. That's where we find them next. Goliath and his brothers are taken out. They're exterminated. We never get another reference to them. Even if you're reading the Septuagint, you have a reference to Enochim in Jeremiah, but it's a reference back to the Philistines. You know, there's just no evidence for this, zero in Scripture, that we have a Nephilim presence beyond the Old Testament period, on into the intertestamental period, on into the New Testament. All we can say is that from the way Paul wrote this, he thought that it could happen again. In other words, there's nothing in his mind that says it can't happen again, but we can't convert that to saying, oh, it was, or it is, or if somebody just, you know, flaunted, you know, their sexuality, some woman in Corinth, that it was going to happen. That was the trigger event. You know, it's going to produce this effect. This is the cause that produces this effect. All of those things are overstatements. They overstate the data. So I don't think we should read into what Paul said. We should just sort of leave it where Paul left it.
Gabriel's second question also is concerning cohabitation. Mm-hmm. Is this what Jesus means in Matthew when he speaks of the days of Noah, marriage, and the end times? And could this possibility have any ties to the man of sin possibly being a result of such things?
Yeah, I mean, we did a little bit of this in the head covering, you know, episode. I mean, Paul is trying to get the Corinthians to do the right thing in terms of sexual modesty and, of course, sexual fidelity within marriage. And again, because you know, he has this concern and other concerns, frankly. He's talking to the Corinthians, and they must have done just about everything, you know, under the sun in this area. But anyway, you know, those things matter, again, for New Covenant living, for New Testament living. Of course, why wouldn't they? You know, fidelity and modesty and whatnot. You know, and Paul is, you know, he's speaking to Gentiles here. I think they understand what's going on clearly. As far as, you know, what's going on, is there some relationship between this and Matthew 24, or the Gospels, or you know, the end times with the man of sin? You know, I don't think that there's any direct proof, any direct even evidence that the Antichrist figure has anything to do with Genesis 6, 1 through 4. Now, the key word there is direct. You did have people, you know, like Irenaeus, that considered Genesis 6, 1 through 4 to be a possible backdrop, that there may be some sort of indirect tie-in between Genesis 6, 1 through 4 and the Antichrist, again, the man of sin. So his argument, you know, was more peripheral, more sort of character-based. You know, he ties it in with the idea that the Gibborim of Genesis 6 were tyrants, and so he thinks that the man of sin is going to be a tyrant. In other words, Irenaeus will talk about Genesis 6, 1 through 4 in relationship to the Antichrist figure, but he never says anything like that cohabitation is going to happen again to produce the Antichrist. He never says anything like that. Neither does anybody else. Neither does any text. Now, personally, I think there are peripheral, indirect connections between the Antichrist figure and the sin of the watchers and, you know, what happens in Genesis 6, 1 through 4. I'm actually working, I've mentioned this a couple times in the podcast, I'm working on a book now about the book of Enoch, basically how the whole book's about how Enoch's story of the transgression of the watchers plays an important role for a number of New Testament writers in their theology. So I'm not going to rabbit trail into that. If I'm sure you won't object to this, Trey, but this is actually sort of a good little infomercial or commercial, I guess, for the newsletter. Because this is exactly the kind of thing that if you subscribe to the newsletter, I'll give you snippets of what I'm working on. I'll give you a portion of this whole, you know, Genesis 6 Antichrist thing that's going to appear in that book, but I won't blog it. I'm not going to blog, you know, what's going to come in a future book, but I will put stuff like that in the newsletter. So I let me just, you know, bring that all down to this point. I don't think there's any direct connection between these two things, Genesis 6, 1 through 4, the Nephilim and the Antichrist. Okay. I do think there are peripheral, indirect, suggestive sort of connections that are not clear. But again, that may indicate that there's something about that event that has a role to play in the Antichrist figure. I know that's kind of a convoluted way to say it, but I think it's better than just saying indirect versus direct. Back to the Matthew 24 thing, I've commented on that before, I think even in a Q&A. I don't think Matthew 24 has any connection to Genesis 6, 1 through 4, because there are no textual connections there. The terminology for marrying and intermarriage in Matthew 24 is not the terminology the Septuagint uses for Genesis 6. If it was, I would change my tune on this. To me, that would be telegraphing a connection, but it just isn't there. And the rest of the things that are described in Matthew 24 about what people were doing before the flood entirely refer to the human population of Noah's day. So to me, it's cheating to take four or five things that are described in Matthew 24, pluck one of them out, and say, oh, this is about the Nephilim. Okay, that to me is not legitimate hermeneutics. But again, if there was a connection via the Septuagint to that passage, well, that would be a little different. Because then to me, again, if you've listened to the podcast long enough, you know, those kinds of things are important to me because the writer is trying to draw our attention back to a specific passage by virtue of the Septuagint. But that does not occur in Matthew 24.
All right, his next question. In breaking down the reasons for the evil state of the earth, Dr. Mike has stated that the watchers are instrumental. So, since their temptation was sexual, could the current and past invasion of perversion and sexual grip, even on Christians, be the evil power's primary method of enforcing their theology or government?
Well, I don't think we need, on one hand, I don't think we need the Watchers to explain human immorality, especially sexual immorality. Everybody has the urge, and they're going to fulfill the urge, and it's pretty much that simple. On the other side of this, it is true that, again, in Second Temple Jewish theology, that the proliferation of evil gets blamed on the Watchers, or at least, you know, the Watchers bear a significant part of the burden, again, in that literature. And by the way, you know, the people in the Second Temple period aren't denying that the human condition, you know, the depravity, they're not denying that depravity is the result of an inner impulse that people just have, again, because they're not God and they're natural born. You know, people are going to sin. So they're not denying that, but they do, you know, look at what goes on with the transgression of the Watchers and assign importance to that because of it sort of, you know, adds gasoline to the fire, you know, to use a modern analogy. It was just something that made the problem worse and accelerated it, which in the Second Temple Jewish mind is why we get Genesis 6:5, you know, that every thought and the imagination of the hearts of people, you know, were only evil continually. If you actually just read Genesis 6:1-4, Genesis 6:1-4 doesn't seem to have any relationship to verse 5. You know, it really doesn't. And it's because it's an abbreviation. It's an abbreviated accounting, really hearkening back specifically to Mesopotamian theology, which I've dealt with at length in Unseen Realm and elsewhere on the podcast. And the view, you know, the issue with Genesis 6:1-4 really isn't about the proliferation of evil among humanity. That's encapsulated in one verse, in verse 5. And that doesn't really... That's not a point that emerges specifically from the Mesopotamian context. So, you know, there are reasons why, you know, you don't get a clear connection in the first five verses of Genesis like you do with Second Temple literature, which goes into more of the backstory and draws out more details of it than the biblical writer did. So, you know, again, you know, what we have here, on one hand, is I don't think, you know, we look at what's happening with the degradation of the moral culture today, you know, sexually, you know, is that some indication of continued Watcher activity or something? I don't believe that. I don't think that's even necessary. Are we still dealing, you know, with depravity and does the Second Temple theology, and of course, New Testament theology. Again, I hate to keep bringing up my book about Enoch, but there's a whole chapter on, you know, Galatians 3:4. We did a whole podcast episode on, you know, just whose sins are we talking about that necessitated the addition of the law to restrain evil. There is this thread of thought in New Testament theology that what happens in Genesis 6:1-4 contributed to the acceleration of depravity. But, you know, that, you know, to just take that event and use that as the explanation for what we see now, again, I think overstates, you know, what's being said there, because human beings are going to do what human beings are going to do, and they're going to react on their impulses. They're going to run from the law of God. They're going to react selfishly, or however you want to characterize. They're going to sin. Okay, they're going to sin. We all sin. We can't help, you know, but sin. And so that can't be minimized to, again, turn our situation, our cultural situation, into something that is purely demonic. And the reason, I'll just throw this in too. The reason why that sort of rubs me the wrong way, and I'm not saying the questioner is thinking this. I mean, there's nothing in the question that would make me think the questioner is thinking this. But I have heard this in other contexts and from other people. It just makes it too easy to say that we're doing this because of demonic powers, demonic forces. The devil made us do this. You know, we can screw up our lives just fine on our own. And I think it sort of lessens our accountability to sort of chalk things up to external forces all the time, or at least sort of want to go there all the time. So I'm a little sensitive to that, because we do need to own what we do. And again, you know, consider our own role in the way we mess up our own lives and the way our culture is going. And I'll add one more thought. If you think our culture is bad, do some reading on Greco-Roman culture. Okay, we have a long way to go before we ever get as bad as some of that. So let's not have, you know, tunnel vision about our own culture. You know, we could actually look at ourselves in many respects and say, boy, we're a whole lot better off than we were back then. And that would be true. Okay, it really would be true. So we want to avoid, again, kind of, you know, having a, again, too much of a perspective that is dominated by our own circumstances as opposed to, you know, what's going on in humanity and other times and really other parts of the world, even today.
All right. Well, Gabriel actually has a fourth question, which actually, okay, Mike, we're going to have a whole show on next week. And it's about Jesus referencing gods as men in Psalm 82 and John 10. And
yeah,
you want to touch on
that? Yeah. I mean, well, yeah, we do need to devote a whole show to that. And that is on the schedule. So, you know, it's good timing anyway, but I have a whole article on this. It was a paper I read in an academic conference, and not an evangelical conference either. This was the Society of Biblical Literature regional meeting of, I don't know how many years ago. But people just don't seem to be able to find this link. I mean, it lives on moreunseenrealm.com, but since people just don't ever seem to be able to find this thing I've written on this question, and I get this question all the time, we really do. We really need to just devote a full episode to this topic, and hopefully we can just sort of send people links so I don't get the question anymore.
Yeah, a lot of confusion on that one. A lot of people get confused. So that's good that we're going to have a whole show next week to that one. So that's good. All right, Mike, Joseph has a question here, and his questions are about Urim and Thummim. I'm doing a word study and found that Urim is related to Ur, maybe the city in Babylon, light, fire, shining flame. So I imagine fiery stones, perhaps. Is there a relationship between the Urim and the stones of fire references?
Yeah, I don't think there's any relationship at all. I mean, the Urim and Thummim were not shiny, glowing, flaming stones, for one thing. They were the two stones that were in the breastplate of the high priest. Now, on the breastplate of the high priest, there were 12 other stones, you know, that when we did Leviticus, I think it's the episode in Leviticus 8, but I don't know the number of the podcast episode. We talked a lot about the Urim and the Thummim, so listeners can go back if they didn't listen to that particular Leviticus episode and get more detail. But we talked about, you know, the Urim and the Thummim were sort of yes and no questions, possibly related to, you know, the kind of thing you would determine by casting lots. And then the question is, well, what about the gemstones on the breastplate? I mean, if anything associated with the high priest is going to be corresponding to light and twinkling and all this kind of stuff, it would not be the Urim and Thummim. It would be those 12 stones. So on that level, I don't think there's anything going on here. I don't think there's any relationship to the city of Ur. Really, I mean, I have to be honest here, that the question, you know, sort of makes some presumptions that are not good presumptions in terms of study method, but they're very common at the same time. And that is, there's a lot of propensity when people are trying to study biblical words to focus on the sound of a word, and when the sound of a word is similar to the sound of a different word, then the assumption is, well, I can connect the meanings of those two separate distinct words because they sound the same. Okay? That is just not the way languages work. It's not the way your own language works, English. I mean, we can come up with all, you could just go all day long, you know, on examples and you know, kind of get a good chuckle out of it. You know, I have a pug, okay? Is the word pug and pugnacious related, really? I mean, I like to call my pug pugnacious, you know, because he'll growl at something. But there's no word relationship between what a pug does by nature. He could be playing with his toy and growling. Well, he's not being pugnacious. He's not being pugilistic either, even though the first three, you know, letters of that word are the same. You know, he's not like violent and fighting anybody. He's not, you know, you get the idea. Just because a language uses sounds, and all languages do, and they get codified, reduced into writing, doesn't mean there's any relationship between sounds. The word chin in English does not mean what chin means in Chinese. Well, they sound exactly the same. Well, no kidding, they do. But so what? The human mouth can only make a certain number of sounds. If you study linguistics or phonology, you'll learn things like that. There's a finite number of sounds that your lips and your tongue and the roof of your mouth and the back of your, there's just a finite number of sounds that any human being can make. And it's something that separates us from any other member of the animal kingdom, even something like a chimp or a gorilla. It's mouth structure, and it's the behavior of the tongue and the teeth and all the parts of your mouth, okay? And even the way that the air flows through. There's a finite number of these. So you have billions and billions and billions of people and tens of thousands of languages, but they're all humans speaking them. So by definition, invariably and inevitably, human languages will produce, human mouths will produce the same sets of sounds. That doesn't mean at all that a sound in one language means, has the meaning to a sound in another language. But this is a fundamental error that is often, I see, often brought into biblical study, biblical word study. It just doesn't work. Languages don't work that way.
All right, the next question is from Michael. I'd love it if you could help me understand a certain Christian doctrine that doesn't make any sense. It is my understanding that the true God of the Bible is a just and righteous God. I cannot comprehend how a just and righteous God can condemn a person for doing something that we were unable to do otherwise. I do not believe that humans are born with Adam's guilt. How can it be our fault? If our choice to sin is due to the nature we were made with, how can God fault us and condemn us for disobeying him when we were unable to do otherwise? Does a person's choice to sin condemn them, or does their nature condemn them?
Yeah, I have to be honest. I don't think that the questioner is thinking well about what the question is focused on. You know, no one is finally condemned by God because they sin. They are guilty before God because they sin, but they can be forgiven. People are condemned, you know, in an ultimate sense by God, not because they sinned, but because they didn't accept Christ. They weren't forgiven. So those are two separate but related things. You know, we are held accountable for our sin because we can refuse to sin. The problem is we won't ever be able to always refuse. We are not perfect. We do not have God's nature. We, you know, as good as we might be at any given point, it will never be unbroken. Okay, we will fail. Okay, we can't, you know, perfectly make the correct choice all of the time. And so we will become guilty. We are accountable because we could have chosen what we did, but we chose to do it. And there are any number of factors as to, you know, why people do what they do and so on and so forth. I mean, just in human behavior, human experience. So, you know, I could turn it around and say, well, if the terrorist who busted into your house kills your child, should they be accountable? Well, of course they should be accountable. The terrorist could have chosen not to do that. Well, to acknowledge they could have chosen not to do that doesn't get them off the hook for doing it. Okay, they are free to make the choice to commit a terrorist act. They are also free to make the choice to not commit the terrorist act. You know, so these individual acts of sin, you know, individual violations of what God wants in terms of, you know, behavior or whatnot, we are accountable for them because we can choose to obey, But if God, of course, knows that we're not perfect, he knows we are going to fail, but we're not condemned because we're fallible. We're condemned ultimately because we never, you know, confessed that. We never turned to the source of forgiveness. We never embraced the forgiveness that God offers. So God knows what he's dealing with. Okay, he knows he's dealing with fallible humans. That's all he's ever going to have in the basket, so to speak. And so God takes it upon himself to solve the problem. So no, nobody goes to, you know, to a Christless eternity because they sinned. They go there because their sin was never taken care of through the cross. Okay, they don't have salvation. They're not saved. Those are two related but different things and distinct things. And what I hear in the question is that distinction is being blurred and in some respects a bit inverted when it comes to articulating, you know, what the concern was in the question.
All right, the last question's from Andrew, and he's wondering if Mike has a working theory on why supernatural occurrences haven't happened in mass since the resurrection of Jesus.
Yeah, my working theory is, how would we know? I mean, just think about the question a little bit. First of all, what does en masse mean? I mean, the largest miracle in the New Testament was 500 people. Okay, so is that en masse? Is it 10? Is it 500? Is it 1,000? Is it a million? I mean, it's hard to even quantify that. And how would we ever know whether another group of 500 people didn't witness a true miracle at some remote point in the Gobi Desert in the 8th century? Okay. Our recorded historical resources are extraordinarily limited. There was no TV. There's no audio recording. There's no internet. In other words, how do we know? And my position, again, my theory is, we don't know. Now, in this regard, I think for people who wonder about this, I would recommend, again, they're a little expensive. I don't get a kickback. You know, I'm not nothing like that. I would recommend Craig Keener's recent two-volume work on miracles. They're thick, they're dense, and Craig goes through lots and lots and lots and lots of sources that we do have, and which is an infinitesimal amount of data compared to the totality of human experience at all times and all places since the resurrection. So this is a minute percentage, but what's actually recorded in terms of miraculous events is a lot bigger than people think. Again, we're used to judging these sorts of things by our own life experience, by the experience of our own family, by what we might see in media that are available to us today. Again, we need to widen the net a little bit, and I would suggest reading that, getting those. Again, I'll admit, and Craig doesn't have anything to do with this either. I know Craig Keener. He's a wonderful guy. But his focus, his area of study, he's a New Testament scholar. And he does a lot with spiritual gifts and miracles and whatnot. I think I could describe him as a small C charismatic, kind of person, at least in his tradition. But he's a legit bona fide scholar. Might actually be something we could entertain to get Craig on the podcast if this is sort of a topic of interest. I'm sure he would do it. But there's a lot more out there as far as quote-unquote evidence for this than you might think. But again, how would we really know is, again, my working position. I just don't see any way we would be able to read the question and consider it factual, because there's just no way to know one way or the other.
For some reason, when Andrew mentioned en masse, I immediately go to like Ghostbusters. See, that's the difference between me and you.
Right, the marshmallow man walking through.
Right, right. You're pulling out references left and right, and I go to Ghostbusters. So,
oh boy, what was his name again? The Stay Puff or something like that.
Yeah, the Stay Puff. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, Stay Puff Marshmallow Man. Yeah,
absolutely. Oh. So I guess this is why I'm not answering these questions, because.
Well, if that's difference. What was meant, no, we haven't seen that.
All right, Mike. Well, just like that, that's it. I want to remind everybody, hey, 2 weeks left to go and vote what the podcast is going to cover, the next book of the Bible. So please go cast your vote. And also, Mike, again, next week we're going to address Jesus's use of Psalm 82 in John chapter 10, right?
Yep. Yes, we will. And again, hopefully provide a convenient, easy to discover place for that question, because I get it so often. It'd be wonderful.
Sounds good. Then you'll just be able to say, hey, boom, go listen to episode 109. There you go. All right, Mike. Well, we appreciate you answering our questions as always. And I want to thank everybody for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.